Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush promised he would get specific about his plans to revamp Social Security. In a primetime press conference last Thursday, he did just that. And now the debate is really on. The president endorsed a plan that would protect the poor, but trim promised benefits for everyone else, over time, deeply.
I believe a reform system should protect those who depend on Social Security the most. So I propose a Social Security system in the future where benefits for low-income workers will grow faster than benefits for people who are better off.
Before last week, personal accounts were the most controversial elements of the president's crusade to revamp Social Security. Now, everyone's talking about progressive indexing and means testing. Supporters say it will save Social Security. Critics say it will kill it. This hour, we'll hear from the architect of the president's plan, investment world executive Robert Posen. He'll lay out the details of how it could work. Then we'll hear from two economists who debate the plan. Tonight on Point, means testing for Social Security. You can join the conversation. Are you on board with the president? Or, if this isn't the way to save Social Security, what would you do? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin tonight in Washington with a look at how the president's proposal is playing on Capitol Hill. Howard Gleckman is senior correspondent for Business Week magazine and joins me now from Washington. Howard, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
So what's the reaction in Congress, Howard? Are people gathering to this, running the other way, something in between? How do you gauge it?
Well, they're sure not gathering to it. I spent Friday and part of today trying to find a Republican willing to embrace this proposal, and I'm still looking.
And that's the Republicans.
Those are Republicans. There are no Democrats who are willing to say they support this. Now, there are Republicans who say, and even privately a few Democrats who say, that the president has made a major step forward by at least beginning the conversation about what to do about benefits. After all the discussion about private accounts never was going to do anything about the real issue, which is solvency. So the president's put that on the table. He gets credit from many Republicans and some Democrats for doing that. But in terms of this specific proposal, no one wants to endorse it because it means benefit cuts, and nobody wants to talk about benefit cuts.
But there are real issues with solvency. Social Security trustees project the system insolvent by 2041, at which point they say it will only be able to pay out 74% of promised benefits. So that's a cut if nothing is done.
That's absolutely right. If nothing is done, we will all face this cliff. And in 2042 or 2052, depending on who's counting, we'll see our benefits reduced by, as you say, about 25%. So the question is, what do you do between now and then? And there are really only two choices. You can either cut benefits or you can raise taxes or you can do a little bit of both. And no one wants to talk about it.
So we heard Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas saying just moments after President Bush's press conference last week, I don't think that's the sort of solution we ought to be going at. That was within seconds, practically, of the president being on air. But he knows exactly what you've just stated. So are Republicans now proposing tax increases to cover the gap?
Absolutely not. And really, neither are Democrats. It's kind of interesting. Democrats talk about the idea of tax increases, but there really aren't very many Democratic proposals out there that really do it. The truth of the matter is no one wants to confront this. And by putting this on the table, the president is beginning to force people to confront it. And by coming up with a proposal that helps, or at least doesn't hurt, low-income people as much as some of the earlier proposals would have, Bob Posen is basically saying to Democrats, got anything better?
Indeed. We'll hear from Mr. Posen in just a moment. Howard Gleckman, the president portrayed this Thursday night. It was real shorthand he described it in. He came around after a reporter's question to sort of saying, in effect, yes, there's means testing here. But his portrayal of it was we're going to protect the poor and just kind of a little haircut for the rest, or the rich, as he put it. In fact, what do the implications look like for lower middle class, upper middle class, and higher Americans, those beyond the poor under this system?
Well, first, a political point. You're absolutely right. He talked in code. If the White House had not told us in advance what it was he was talking about, mm-hmm. we wouldn't have had any idea. This was in a language that nobody, certainly outside of Washington, could have understood, and probably a lot of people inside of Washington couldn't have either. As to what it means, let's take an average worker. Average income today is about $36,000 a year.
Okay.
An average worker would see a benefit reduction, who retires in say 30 years, would see a benefit reduction of about 20% over promised benefits. Now, again, the issue is there is no money to pay, or at least not sufficient money to pay promised benefits. So the question is, how much less than that are we going to give people? Under the, as we discussed before, under the do-nothing proposal, we'd also see a benefit cut of about 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how do you skew that so that lower-income people see, in the POSA plan, actually no benefit cut? Those people making that average income that we just talked about would see a benefit cut of about 20%. Higher-income people would see rather large benefit cuts. And, in fact, higher-income people born today who retire, let's say, in 2070 or 2075 would see really very little in guaranteed benefit.
And what do you mean by higher income? Starting where?
People
in current dollars.
People making more than $60,000, and then it sort of moves up from there. By the time you're making $100,000, this, again, is average wages over your lifetime.
So that's hardly extraordinary high income.
No,
in today's economy.
Certainly not in places like Boston and Washington. It's not. That's right. And those people would see a guaranteed benefit essentially disappear down the road. Now, under the Bush proposal, of course, what they would get in exchange is the private accounts, which would allow them to generate a certain amount of income, which would make up for at least some of what they're going to lose. But again, the issue here is one way or another, unless we raise taxes, benefits are going to be reduced. So the question is, whose benefits are going to be reduced? Will some people get a pass here and see no reduction in benefits? Will everybody have to get something of a benefit reduction?
Or will we see some whopping bigger taxes along the way?
Well, that's the other issue. And, of course, the president hasn't exactly said he wouldn't support that. He said he won't support tax rate increases, has left open the possibility of raising what they call a cap, which is the maximum salary on which your Social Security is taxed.
So a lot still on the table, and as you say, Howard Gleckman, Congress doing anything but rallying strongly around this at the moment.
That's right, and it's a fairly simple calculation. The higher you raise taxes, the lower you have to reduce benefits, at least from promised levels. The less you raise taxes, the more you have to reduce benefits from promised levels. There's no way to get around that. Private accounts isn't the magic bullet. There is no magic bullet. You either cut benefits or you raise taxes or you do a little bit of both.
It's paralyzed Congress for a long time, and it may do it for a while to come, but there's something on the table now. Howard Gleckman, thanks very much for explaining it for us tonight.
Good to talk to you.
Howard Gleckman, senior correspondent for Businessweek magazine. He spoke with me from Washington. We're joined now from Boston by Robert Posen. He's chairman of MFS Investment Management. It's a $145 billion-plus investment management firm, manages money for individuals and institutional investors. He's a former member of President Bush's Commission to Strengthen Social Security and is widely regarded as the architect of the plan that the president very broadly outlined in his press conference on Thursday night. We're delighted to have him. Mr. Posen, thanks for joining us this evening.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
I wish you'd be good enough to explain to us what progressive indexing is and what you're proposing here and why.
Right now, when someone's career average earnings are computed at the time they initially get their Social Security benefits, we then increase that by the amount that wages have gone up over their career, not the amount prices have gone up. And wages go up about 1% more a year than prices. So if we want to make the system solvent, we've got to do something either on the benefit side or on the taxes side. And my idea is to say, let's divide the world into three groups, low earners, high earners, and middle earners.
Mm-hmm.
For low earners, we would continue to wage index their benefits so they would get exactly the same. And I also would not touch anybody who benefits who retires before 2012.
Yes.
For high earners, which I define as earnings of $113,000 and higher, that's not income, that's earnings. So even in Boston, that's a pretty good salary.
We just heard $56,000. What's the discrepancy there?
$56,000 is a medium earner.
I see.
And I don't, you know, I'm not sure exactly where that number is.
Okay.
But also, I'm dealing with 2012. My plan doesn't begin to 2012, so numbers that are given that relate to today's earnings levels are a bit irrelevant and a bit misleading.
So the so-called high-income earners, you'd move entirely to index on the basis of...
The only people who would be moved entirely to price indexing are people who have earnings of $113,000 and higher in 2012. That's what we're talking about.
And those in the middle, a kind of blend of the two.
Yeah, there's a blend, and I think people are basically... What you're hearing is that people don't like the blend. They want to have a little more wage indexing in the middle than price indexing, and this sort of calibration can be made. But I think... The important thing is that we really do need to do something. If we start to do things that are reasonable and moderate now, we can do them over long periods of time and avoid this default of the system in about 2040. At that point, you'll have about 26 or 27% cut in benefits. So it's easy to say that my proposal involves a benefit cut. But it really doesn't involve a benefit cut. It only involves a benefit cut relative to a schedule which we can't afford by about $4 trillion. That's how much today we're short on this proposal. I think more reasonable measures are what would happen to, say, the middle wage worker who's, say, at $47,000 in 2045. Well, they would have 16% less than scheduled benefits. But if the system defaults, they'll have 27% less. So it's a better deal for them. It's more humane. It's more feasible. It's more reasonable to get a 16% reduction rather than a 27% reduction.
Robert Posen, there's a lot more we want to learn. We've got to take a short break here. Please stick with us. Robert Posen, chairman of MFS Investment Management and architect of President Bush's Social Security plan. Are you on board with the president? Are guarantees for the poor and cuts in promised benefits for everyone else the way to go? Is it the only way to go? What's the alternative? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about means testing, progressive indexing for Social Security, about President Bush's latest proposal, guarantees for the poor, and something else for everyone else. You can join the conversation tonight. Does this change the fundamental promise of Social Security? Does that matter? Do we have a choice? Are you just happy to hear that there's something concrete on the table? And if there has to be some kind of plan, is this the best option? Do you have a better plan? Do the Democrats? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight by Robert Posen, chairman of MFS Investment Management. It's a very large investment management firm and manages money for individuals and institutional investors. Robert Posen, as soon as this came out, even before, but as soon as it came out, there are numbers gushing all over. You say it won't really be cuts, and we know, of course, this is semantic. I mean, things will rise, but they'll rise at a different rate. Of course, they've risen on the basis of wage indexing for an awfully long time. It's what people are used to. So you know there's some pain involved in this. As you looked at the field of options here, raising taxes to cover the shortfall, or raising the retirement age, or what you've proposed, progressive indexing, why did you end up on this one as opposed to the others?
Well, I think that raising retirement age, which is a logical solution, turns out to be politically the least popular solution by all the polls. And more importantly, it really discriminates against people who have a lot of physical labor. And those tend to be the low-wage workers, people who have construction jobs, who are on assembly lines. And I think that the main purpose of Social Security ought to be to provide a retirement floor of income for people in low wages who have no other source of retirement income. And that's why I don't believe that my proposal is means testing, because people who say that are just looking at Social Security alone. This has to be viewed in terms of 401ks, IRAs, and other sources of retirement income. And if we look at who has those 401ks and IRAs, we can see that they're heavily concentrated in the middle and higher income groups, and the low-wage workers really don't have that. Moreover, the government subsidizes those. The tax subsidy for 401ks and IRAs in 2004 was about $55 billion, and that tax subsidy all went to the higher and middle-wage workers. So if we think about overall government support for retirement programs, including Social Security as well as private retirement plans, we really need something like progressive indexing to treat all earnings groups pretty much the same. So the higher wage worker is getting a little less growth in Social Security, other benefits. These benefits will still be growing, but they're getting a lot of tax subsidies in 401ks and IRAs, and that's true to a substantial extent to the middle wage worker.
But you know, when Americans look around these days, and you know this, they see defined benefit pensions going away. They see their IRAs and 401ks very often not looking like a sufficient pillow to retire on. I mean, people in the middle class and even the upper middle class are very uneasy. All the polls show it about their retirement. The notion of Social Security growing in a less fulsome way to meet their needs at retirement is unnerving. You must feel that just in the response of congressmen.
Yeah, most people didn't think that didn't even know that their Social Security benefits were wage indexed. We will be increasing purchasing power for the middle wage worker. They will, in fact, receive about a 20% increase in purchasing power in terms of their Social Security benefits. That means that they will be able to buy 20% more goods and services in a year like 2055 with their Social Security check than they do today. So these people will be getting more. But I think, ultimately, we do have to encourage the middle and high wage worker to have retirement, private retirement plans. And I think as part of any piece of legislation, we will see better and more incentives for retirement plans. And I think those will be utilized mainly by middle and higher wage workers. And hopefully that will satisfy some of the concerns that you expressed.
What about raising tax revenues to cover this so that people could still look forward to that kind of fully funded Social Security that current retirees have? What's the problem with that, economic or otherwise?
I think that people have to be realistic about how high you would have to raise taxes in order to solve this problem. Some people say, for instance, let's raise the wage base on which the 12.4% FICA tax is now levied, mm-hmm. from $90,000 to $150,000. Well, first of all, you ought to realize that that would only close about one-third of the deficit of Social Security. So we still would need very significant benefit changes to deal with the rest of the gap. The second is, think about all those earners who are making $150,000 or $200,000. All of a sudden, they're going to be paying 12.4% tax on a new large part of their earnings, and the person who's a millionaire won't actually be paying on much of his or her earnings.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be a very substantial tax. In order to do this by taxes, we would have to raise taxes by a huge amount to deal with this $4 trillion gap. Some people are really saying is they didn't like the tax cut from several years ago and they really want to repeal it. That's essentially what they're saying. And if Congress is prepared to repeal the tax cut from several years ago, then you probably could raise that sort of revenue. But I see no interest in Congress in doing that. And by the way, there are at least two people in Congress, Senator Bennett on the Senate side and Congressman Colby on the House side, who are drafting bills today that incorporate progressive indexing. So contrary to what your reporter said in Washington, there is a lot of interest in this on both sides of the aisle. I would say Democrats have been reluctant to take a public position on Social Security reform generally. But I think there are a number of people in Congress who are going forward and drafting with progressive indexing and other aspects of the retirement reform program that they're interested in.
And Robert Posen, what about the charge that this will, over time, turn Social Security into a welfare benefit, a welfare plan for the poor? It will rob the system of the kind of real universal participation that's kept it so deeply supported by the American public to date, and fundamentally change the whole kind of New Deal idea behind it.
Well, I think that's wrong for two reasons. First of all, I bring progressive indexing up till about 2079. That's the end of the period in which we judge Social Security solvency. And at that time, there still will be a 20% difference between the Social Security benefits of high-wage workers and low-wage workers. People have pointed out that if you run this into the next century, then you start to get some unusual things. But I'm not planning on that, and I think no one should try to run a system beyond 2079. We just don't know what's going to happen. The second thing is, I think we have to realize that the people who say that are often the people who say, well, let's raise payroll taxes. If we raise payroll taxes on high-wage workers, I think they're more likely to drop their support for the Social Security system than if we say in 20 or 30 years from now, you're going to have slower growth of benefits. I mean, think about this. If you're making $150,000 a year and someone says, will you support a system if you get a 12.4% tax levy now on all of your earnings between $90,000 and $150,000, and that occurs tomorrow and for the rest of your career, versus you're going to have slower growth of benefits 20 or 30 years out? I think we're likely to have more support from the higher wage worker for slower growth of their benefits under Social Security combined with what they're getting under IRAs and 401ks than any other approach. And I've tried that out on a lot of people, and we've done surveys, and that seems to be the direction. Not that high-wage people are going to love it, but they think that that's a realistic approach and surely much more preferable to the other alternatives that are available.
Robert Posen, very quickly, just one more question here. Over the decades, FDR has been looked back on very fondly by seniors who have retired on Social Security as we know it. If this should go through, your name's going to be very closely associated with it. How do you think seniors will look back 50 years from now on Robert Posen if this is the system that they're living under?
Well, I think they will look upon it and think it's a reasonable and fair approach. Everybody in their 20s and 30s doesn't know whether they're going to be a high-wage worker or they're going to be a middle-wage worker or a low-wage worker. So this is a system that says contribute, and then depending on where you wind up, will either give you a little more or a little less in Social Security. At the same time, we're building up the 401ks and IRAs. We increased the contribution limits a few years ago. We increased the tax incentives. And I think people are more and more seeing that what retirement income is about is a combination of Social Security and these other retirement programs. This is not like FDR's time. Quite frankly, it's not like it was in 1970 or 1980. Now, these sorts of private retirement programs are an integral part. And when people think about retirement planning, they think about Social Security as one part, and we want to have that keep growing, not as fast as was before for higher income people, but the whole package will make sense to them. And I think that will seem to be a reasonable total package.
Brave new world. We'll see if Americans walk into it. Robert Posen, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Robert Posen, chief architect of the plan that President Bush began to roll out last Thursday night before reporters at the White House, chairman of MFS Investment Management in Boston. We are joined now from Berkeley, California, by Brad DeLong, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, from 1993 to 95. He was deputy assistant secretary for economic policy at the Treasury Department. Brad DeLong, thanks for being with us tonight.
I'm very happy to be here tonight.
And with us from Philadelphia, Kent Smetters. He's professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, faculty research fellow at the Aging Program at the National Bureau of Economic Research. From 2001 to 2002, he was deputy assistant secretary of economic policy in President Bush's first administration. Kent Smetters, thank you for joining us tonight.
Good to be here.
Brad DeLong, first to you. You've heard Robert Posen tonight, and I'm sure before, put forward his progressive indexing plan. What do you think of it?
Well, I think it commits us to do five things. The first is keeping Social Security benefits for the working poor on their current law track. And also, at least in Robert Posen's formulations, putting us on the road to tapping income tax revenues to cover a fairly significant remaining Social Security deficit on a significant scale in the second half of this century.
Because it doesn't solve the whole problem.
No. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it also commits us to, you know, a vision of Social Security that holds that retirement, that it sets part of retirement income is primarily intended to protect the elderly against destitution, that it's not a program for everyone to keep everyone from suffering a sharp fall in their incomes if their other assets go south.
Mm-hmm.
and that it also entails us to fairly ferocious benefit cuts relative to current law, right, for the better half of America's population in the second half of this century.
Robert Posen says they're not such a big deal, it won't be so bad, they'll have 401ks and IRAs.
Yes, but they'll have very little left in terms of a replacement rate from Social Security. You know, now, progressive price indexing, Posen's plan, it's neither left-wing nor right-wing, mm-hmm. right? Insulating the working poor from benefit cuts and tapping income tax revenues to fund a bigger Social Security plan that can be funded from concurrent tax rate, that's fairly liberal. To think of Social Security as kind of providing a more or less baseline protection against destitution, say $22,000 of today's dollars a year for pretty much everyone as their Social Security benefit for 2075.
Mm-hmm.
For Social Security to become a protection against destitution and not the provision of a stable, certain baseline replacement rate, that's more or less conservative.
And do you see this as being sustainable, or politically do you see this as ultimately leading to higher-income Americans turning against Social Security as another welfare program and the thing falling apart? Is this the death of Social Security politically?
I really don't know, right? That is, I don't know anyone who knows what the politics of the 2050s and the 2060s and the 2070s will be like. And what will happen if we do indeed arrive at a situation where people's Social Security benefits are more or less proportional to their income, and yet everyone's getting very much the same, close to the same paycheck.
Bottom line, are you for or against Robert Posen's proposal?
Well, I'm saying I could be for it in the right context. But I'm saying that there are things that about it that are hard to swallow.
Ken Smithers, let me turn to you, if I may. You were in the Bush administration. You know some of the thinking there, the kind of instincts there. Were you surprised to hear the president put this one forward?
No, because I think the idea of trying to control the growth rate of Social Security benefits was always high on the agenda, and to do that in a progressive way that doesn't impact at the bottom end. And so what this plan really does is that it deals with a large portion of the long-term problem. It doesn't deal with it all, but a large portion of mm-hmm. it in a pretty progressive way. Now, we have to point out, because the average listener probably doesn't quite understand when politicians and talk about benefit cuts and things like that. You almost have to be a worker in the office of the actuary to really know all these little details.
Yes, you do.
But most people, when you say benefit cut, what they think is that in the future, they won't be able to buy as many goods and services as retirees today. The benefits are going down after you adjust for inflation. The president's plan, even under the people who are on the very high end who are getting their benefits now growing with inflation instead of wages, their benefits are not going to go down in terms of purchasing power. That is, the same TVs and the cars that people can buy today, people in the future will be able to buy.
Right, but let me ask you about that. I mean, because, of course, the standard of living changes. People have watched
yeah.
seniors over many decades keep up with that standard of living. I've heard it said that if it had been wage indexing or price indexing ever since Social Security began, yes, the elderly would still have the purchasing power of 1930s elders, and they'd have ice chests and outhouses instead of refrigerators and indoor plumbing.
Yes, and that's exactly right in the sense that...
It doesn't sound so appealing.
Well, but keep in mind, the standard of living today is so much higher than it was back then. And so it is true that, you know, if people are driving around in space mobiles someday in the future, they won't be happy with cars. But the fact of the matter is we have a much, much higher standard of living, so I don't think the comparison is completely fair. But it is true that any reform plan, I'm worried about it being consistent over time, that is, future Congresses trying to create more unfunded promises. But keep in mind something here is that it's really easy to kind of criticize this plan. I'm not saying Brad mm-hmm. DeLong does this, mm-hmm. but certainly Nancy Pelosi is going around saying how terrible this thing is, but did not offer a plan of their own. So I think it's really important to have parity here in this whole discussion, and that is maybe a rule. You can't criticize without a plan of your own. I mean, it's not fair to simply say to try look at one plan that is actually close to sustainable and compare it with the current system that we cannot afford, that's completely unsustainable. It's like comparing a Mercedes against a Ford.
We hear it, Kent Smithers, and we're going to turn to that after a short break. But first, just briefly, Brad DeLong, if I may, do you think that seniors in 2050 are going to feel satisfied with what they get under the president's tailored Social Security and under progressive indexing? Kent Smithers says, well, they'll have the same purchasing power as today. Will that feel adequate?
Well, the poorest third of seniors retiring in 2060 are going to have kind of current law benefits. Right?
But
their benefits are going to grow as fast as they're currently scheduled to grow.
We've got that. But if you're making the equivalent of 35, 40, 60, 90.
90,000, your benefits are going to be two-thirds of current law.
Will that hurt?
Yes,
will that pinch?
That'll hurt. That'll hurt a bunch. That won't hurt as much as reducing the benefits, as kind of reducing the benefits of the relatively poor relative to current law.
Brad DeLong at Berkeley, Kent Smithers at the Wharton School. Please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about Social Security, about President Bush's latest proposal. Will this save Social Security? Is this, in effect, the end of Social Security? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about means testing for Social Security, about President Bush's latest proposal, guarantees for the poor, and something else for everyone else. You can join the conversation tonight. Will this save the program, or is this, in effect, the end of Social Security as we've known it? Does it turn it over time into old-fashioned welfare? Is it a backdoor privatizing of Social Security? Are you waiting for the Democrats' plan? Are we closer here to a solution? Will this plan fly? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight from Philadelphia by Kent Smithers, professor at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, and from Berkeley, California, Brad DeLong, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. Right now, Al is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I'm representing a progressive group in Erie called Lake Erie Alliance for Democracy. We've put together a position paper on Social Security.
And where do you come down, Al? What do you want to do?
Okay, I agree with many of the points made by Robert Posen, but your guest. But I'd like to elaborate on two. First of all, with regard to increasing the cap on which Social Security tax is withheld.
Yes.
That's not really a tax increase for the wealthy people. I'll give you one example. Right now, the cap is $90,000.
Right.
The average wage earner, which was mentioned earlier, is now paying 6.2% of their wages are being deducted. A person now who earns $190,000 has 3% of their wages deducted for Social Security.
Each month, because it adds up so much more quickly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But you do see that if the cap was raised, those people would be paying more.
They would be paying the same as the average worker is now paying.
Okay, so you'd raise the cap. What else would you do, Al?
All right, that's one solution to the problem of solvency. The other one is to roll back the tax cuts on the rich, and that would be a very good solution to the solvency problem of Social Security. The concept of privatization, which President Bush and Senator Santorum from Pennsylvania
yes.
have been advocating, is the worst possible solution to the problem.
And what about progressive indexing? What was put on the table last week?
That, I think, is a good solution, yes.
You're for it, but it doesn't have to do with raising the cap. It doesn't have to do with rolling back taxes on the wealthy.
It doesn't solve the whole problem.
So you've got some more pieces of a solution here.
Of cures. And progressive indexing is one. That's part of it.
And bring on the rest. Al, we've got it. Thank you very much for your call and for your good work there. Kent Smithers, Al's not opposed to progressive indexing, but he wants to bring some more pieces to the puzzle here. Let's raise that cap, have people paying all the way up to $190,000 maybe, and roll back the tax cuts for the wealthy. Could we do that and make the progressive indexing bite a little less deeply?
Well, there's a couple issues here. The first is the president has not ruled out increasing the cap. It is true that's about 15% of the population is above the cap. In the old days, it was closer to 10, so mm-hmm. there's maybe some room there. We have to keep in mind, though, that this would have an impact on many small employers. And it's also important to keep in mind that the wealthier, they also get a much smaller benefit relative to what they paid into the current system.
Yeah, but everybody's going to have some pain here. What about rolling back the tax
absolutely.
Cuts?
But I'm just making it. Mm-hmm. I'm just taking away the fact that it just kind of yep. sounds like a freebie. The tax cuts, I think, really have to kind of stand their own. The reason why we do tax cuts, and in the way that the tax cuts were done, weren't perfect by any means, but the whole logic behind the tax cuts is that the U.S. faces a real competitive problem internationally if we, in fact, do not reduce tax rates on capital income in particular, where our effective tax rates on capital income in the United States are much higher than even in high-tax places like Europe, Germany, and so forth.
Well, they shouldn't look that way on the face of it.
They should have what?
They don't look that way on the face of it when you look at it.
They don't look that way, but keep in mind, in many European countries, they actually don't tax capital gains and lots of other things. They actually have very low taxes on capital income. They rely heavily on a value-added tax.
Right, so you'd stick up for those taxes on wealthy Americans. Let's get another caller. Joe is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Hello. One thing that I can't understand... we have 77 million, I'm a grandfather, so-called boomers, and they have 80 million children. And we don't mind paying $10,000 per pupil per child. For a child to go through high school is $150,000.
Yes.
Now we're talking about raising the age to 67. And I believe the wage, the average age is 72. I've outlived that. But we don't mind spending that. And to me, to make predictions on what's going to happen 60 years from now is ludicrous.
Joe, let me ask you, are you living on Social Security now?
I have Social Security, but I'm not living on that entirely.
And if your benefit was cut, I don't know what you made when you were working, but if it was cut by 30%, would that be a problem for you?
Yes, it would. Plus the fact that the average Social Security check now is $900 a month. $900 a month isn't very much money in today's, and one-third of the recipients, that's all that they get. They are completely dependent on it.
Right. We hear that. Joe, thank you very much for your call, and good luck there. Brad DeLong, here's the voice of the retired person saying, you know, if you can talk about 25, 26, 30, 40% cuts, but if you come in and do that, that's going to hurt, and presumably it will hurt in the year 2030 and 2040, too.
It'll only hurt a little bit in 2030. The cuts take a long time to get rolling. It's the people beyond 2050 who are seeing the substantial benefit cuts. And this is indeed a thing to worry about progressive price indexing. Right? That is, Kant is right, yeah, that we're overwhelmingly likely to have benefit cuts of some kind and tax increases of some kind in order to balance this program, which is truly valuable. The questions are, who do the benefit cuts land on, and who do the tax increases land on?
But let me ask you there. You're at Berkeley, famously a land of no small number of lefties. But I can hear in your voice you can't stand to criticize here a program that still protects the poor. But what about the rest of working Americans and the deal that has traditionally been theirs under Social Security? I mean, they work, too, even if they're not in poverty. Can our country simply not afford its traditional promise anymore?
Can we not afford it? I mean, the underlying point that Kant and people like him are making is that when you have an economy where population's growing at 1.5% per year and productivity is growing at 2% per year, you can support a much bigger Social Security program with a lower tax rate than when you have a population that's growing significantly more slowly.
Which we have now, you're saying, and in the future.
Yeah, which we're likely to have now. We're no longer have the huge run-up from the
Great Depression to the baby boom generation.
So you're basically saying, too bad, working America, we just can't afford the old deal. A lot of Democrats are denying that.
It requires much bigger tax rates on the young in 2070 than it required on the young in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's a bargain with the young and the old in 2000, you can't simply roll that bargain forward and say we're going to replace the same share of income in 2070 for the old, that the young in 2070 have to pay much higher tax rates. That's just tough.
I want to get one more caller in here. Ofer is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ofer, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah.
And first of all, I'd like to say, Red DeLong, I find your blog very informative. I think the presentation of the issues at the beginning of the program was very misleading. I'm glad that you later acknowledged that raising the retirement age is one of the options available, and that's certainly
sure.
something that can be done without hurting unduly the poorer by having more creative exemptions for early retirement. However, I think the most misleading part of the introduction was the way you characterized what the do-nothing option is. There are 2 points to that. Number one, these projections for what happens in mid-century are based on assuming a much slower rate of productivity growth than we've had in the last decade and a slower rate of economic growth than we've had in the last decade. And so, sure, it's a prudent and pessimistic estimate, but it's so far out in the future, we don't really know that Social Security is ever going to go into deficit. If economic growth or productivity growth continue as they have been, Social Security is not going to go into deficit.
We're going to have to take it right there. Our time is so short, and I apologize for that, but let me pick that up. Brad DeLong, let me put it to you. It's prudent but pessimistic to go with the numbers from the Social Security trustees that in 2041 they'll only be able to afford 74% of promised benefits. Do you agree with Ofer?
I think they're a bit over-pessimistic, but I also think that faster economic growth of the kind we're likely to get isn't going to cover the whole hole, which is, I think, one reason that it's important to get people better opportunities to save for their retirement. George W. Bush wants to cut out of the current Social Security funding stream a whole bunch of money for private accounts. I'd prefer to make it extremely easy for individuals to add to that funding stream. Say, devote half your tax refund to a private Social Security account by checking a box on your tax return, for example. That in some ways, the big debate we ought to be having is how do we make it much easier for people, especially the not rich, to save more easily in low-fee accounts.
Well, it's interesting. Tonight, I hear less opposition, even from you, Brad DeLong, to what the president's putting forward than I've heard from Democratic quarters, and then I've heard willingness among most Republicans on Capitol Hill to stand up and support. It will be fascinating to see how this evolves. Brad DeLong at Berkeley, thank you very much for joining us tonight. And Kent Smetters at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, Laura Bush tries her hand at stand-up comedy. This is On Point. First Lady Laura Bush stepped in from the wings and stole the show from her husband on Saturday night at the annual White House Correspondents' Association dinner in Washington, as the president began his keynote address by rehashing some of his failed jokes from the campaign. A fully prepped Laura Bush stood up and said, "Not that old joke, not again." She then stepped to the podium and delivered an 8-minute roast of her husband and other administration officials that left the correspondents in stitches. It was a well-choreographed performance by the popular First Lady, perhaps designed to bolster her husband, whose popularity has been sagging in the polls. But regardless of the politics, it was said to be just plain funny. Here's some of Saturday's stand-up from First Lady Laura Bush.
I've been attending these dinners for years. And just quietly sitting there. Well, I've got a few things I want to say for a change. This is going to be fun because he really doesn't have a clue about what I'm going to say next. George always says he's delighted to come to these press dinners. Baloney. He's usually in bed by now. I'm not kidding. I said to him the other day, George, if you really want to end tyranny in the world, you're going to have to stay up later. I am married to the President of the United States, and here's our typical evening. 9 o'clock. Mr. Excitement here is sound asleep. And I'm watching Desperate Housewives. With Lynn Cheney. Ladies and gentlemen, I am a Desperate Housewife. I mean, if those women on that show think they're desperate, they ought to be with George. One night after George went to bed, Lynn Cheney, Condi Rice, Karen Hughes, and I went to Chippendales. I wouldn't even mention it, except Ruth Ginsburg and Sandra Day O'Connor saw us there. I won't tell you what happened, but Lynn's Secret Service code name is now Dollar Bill. But George and I are complete opposites. I'm quiet, he's talkative. I'm introverted, he's extroverted. I can pronounce nuclear. The amazing thing, however, is that George and I were just meant to be. I was a librarian who spent 12 hours a day in the library, yet somehow I met George. We met and married, and I became one of the regulars up at Kennebunkport. All the Bushes love Kennebunkport, which is like Crawford, but without the nightlife. People ask me what it's like to be up there with the whole Bush clan. Let me put it this way. First prize, 3-day vacation with the Bush family. Second prize, 10 days. Speaking of prizes brings me to my mother-in-law. So many mothers today are just not involved in their children's lives. Not a problem with Barbara Bush. People often wonder what my mother-in-law is really like. People think she's a sweet, grandmotherly Aunt B type. She's actually more like Don Corleone.
First Lady Laura Bush bringing down the house at the annual White House Correspondents Association dinner Saturday night in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.